Our latest guest is the answer to the trivia question. The first ever St. Louis Ram drafted in this town. That would be Kevin Carter, 1995 sixth overall pick out of the University of Florida. Kevin Carter had a great run in St. Louis, spent 6 years here, became a Pro Bowler, 17 sacks in the 99 season when the Rams won the Super Bowl. And he's got a really interesting story about what he knew about Dick Vermeil, why they're so close. And it dates back to his college days when Vermeil was still in broadcasting. And I've always wondered if Carter, who was the original St. Louis Ram, wondered if he would have ended up staying in St. Louis his entire career, except he did have a falling out. And it was a weird deal because, yeah, he was having a contract dispute, but then he was having a baby. He missed a practice. And he never missed a game his entire NFL career, but he missed a practice and got sideways with Mike Bartz. But the backstory was Carter's agent, a local guy, Harold Lewis, had called the Rams and said, hey, listen, Kevin's running to the hospital. His wife's having a baby. There's some complications. And it became sort of a media thing where Carter was in trouble. The Rams fined him. Martz was mad. And lo and behold, the next year he's gone, traded, went to the Tennessee Titans. So Kevin played for Mike Martz. He played for Dick Vermeil, came to town with Rich Brooks. Along the way, he had John Gruden in Tampa, Nick Saban in Miami, Jeff Fisher in Tennessee, Steve Spurrier in college. I mean, Carter could just write a book about all the coaching experiences he's had. You may see him these days on CBS Sports Network, part of their college football coverage. And as you can tell in this interview, always one of the most thoughtful, articulate sound bites we would get when we go out to the locker room at Rams Park. Every answer is well thought out. Great recollection of what went right in 99 and how there was near mutiny in 98 when Vermeil was beating the snot out of these players and trying to build this thing up. And I've been wanting to talk to Kevin Carter for a long time, not just his Vermeil stories, but about his career, his time in St. Louis, and a great little nugget by him about what it's like to be a former Ram in St. Louis and now the team's in L.A. What does that feel like when you get called out there to go to a game and nobody out there really knows, not that they don't know who you are. He had a long career, over 100 sacks in the NFL, but that you have no connection to. And he gives a pretty honest answer about that, his thoughts on the NFL. Moving out of St. Louis yet again. Kevin Carter, very enjoyable conversation, all these different topics. Hope you'll enjoy it. It's presented, as always, by Triad Bank, St. Louis-based bank since 2005. And that means when you need a home loan, a car loan, a business loan, all of the decisions are made right here in town. Jim Regna, the CEO, is about as St. Louis as you can get. He went to Rosary High School, then he went to UMSL. His entire team, all about helping business owners here in town. Stop by and see him on Clayton Road in Frontenac or on the web at triadbanking.com. B&G Tuck Pointing, they are the best in the bricks. And that means your brick home will look brand new again with one phone call, 363-0525, 363-0525, or the website, bgtuckpointing.com. They also do foundation repair, waterproofing. Great examples online of the before and after photos of a building. Maybe it's a place of business. They do commercial and residential. bgtuckpointing.com, 363-0525. Appliance Discounters, they've been around for about 15 years now. Started with a real simple idea. Denise Bradley and her husband John, her brother Tony, the three of them, that was it. The original employees selling folks appliances at the lowest prices. And it's grown from there. They have every type of appliance, all the big names, any type of appliance you need, they'll get it. And they'll get it quickly. In the midst of all this supply chain talk, not an issue at Appliance Discounters. Check them out on the web at theappliancediscounters.com. Always have those great GE rebates as well, General Electric. And once you do business with them, you'll be back for more. You'll find out why their savings are your savings and the service also outstanding. Marie Davila Senior Living is the corner of Clayton and Wideman Road. It's a beautiful 60-acre campus in West County, the premier spot for your senior years. They have villa estates, assisted living, all levels of care. Real easy to take a virtual tour at mariedevilla.com. That's M-A-R-I-D-E-V-I-L-L-A, mariedevilla.com. Great spot for your retirement years. Really a beautiful setting in West County. All right, here we go with Kevin Carter, the original St. Louis Ram.
Well, Kevin, it's been a while since we talked, and I think a lot of former Rams have been on my brain since visiting Dick Vermeil in the woods of Pennsylvania. I should probably know this. Have you been to the cabin, the Vermeil cabin?
I have not actually been to the actual cabin. I've heard a lot about it, though.
Yeah, he is tucked in the woods, but still, I mean, this would not surprise you. His basement, you know how meticulous he was, detail-oriented. His basement has one corner dedicated to the Rams years, and it's got every Sports Illustrated, every newspaper clipping perfectly framed. Then he's got the corner for the Eagles. Then you go over here, it's the Chiefs and his UCLA years. I forgot the Rose Bowl he won. He beat Woody Hayes at Ohio State, but it's just a beautiful spread, and his memories of all his former players are alive and still talks about guys like you. And I think I'll start with Vermeil, since that's kind of what made me think of you recently, and we texted, reached out. What did you know about him? You had already been here 2 years. You're in the NFL in St. Louis for a couple of years, and then Vermeil comes in out of broadcasting. I'm thinking guys in the locker room like, oh, man, who's this dude?
Well, you know, I was a little different. Being that I was a college player, you know, we were all college guys, but I was fortunate enough to cross paths with him as a broadcaster. He was doing one of our games. I believe he was doing the Tennessee game my sophomore year. And we were going up to Neyland Stadium. And, you know, usually these crews come in and they do the games. They talk to coaches. They don't really talk to players that much. And I was a young player at the time, a true sophomore back in 1992. And I remember having the most wonderful conversation with this, you know, this little old man who was standing on the sideline. And I knew who he was because, you know, I was a big Cowboys fan, and his Eagles beat my Cowboys in the championship game, a long time ago when I was a kid. And so we started talking. You know, he asked me all kind of questions about my parents and, you know, what my motivation was and who I was, what made me tick, just all types of things that were just not related to football. And I ended up having a pretty good game. He said some nice things about me. I crossed paths with him again at some point. Just really liked who he was as a human being and had an appreciation just for someone who was a little bit more eclectic and a little bit more caring and had a little bit more substance to him than most of the football coaches and people in the football world, you know, that I'd come across. And he wasn't afraid to let that side show, and which I thought was really cool at the time. So in my, you know, going into my third year when, you know, Rich Brooks got the axe and that whole staff changed, and in comes Dick Vermeil, you know, bringing in, you know, Mike White and George, Jim Hannifin, and, you know, all these old coaches, you know, out of retirement. And I was there at the press conference on bated breath. I mean, I could not wait for this man to be my head coach. But the one, you know, thing that I couldn't quite make sense of was the attitude that I had in college, you know, seemed to be completely different from the mentality of an NFL team. I went to Florida. I played for Coach, you know, Steve Spurrier, and everyone was doing everything they could to win every game. And the competition was intense, and it was the atmosphere that we created. We had a culture that was a winning culture, and I come to the Rams, and, you know, it wasn't quite the case. Not that the coaches weren't good, but just the mentality was different. It was a little bit more selfish and every man for himself, and people were worried about, you know, being in contract years and making their incentives and whatnot. And it was just a different mentality, and it was kind of foreign to me. And, you know, but that's the risk you run. You don't know what kind of organization you're going to go to as a college kid. And, you know, it's a business also. So there's so many differences in the NFL and pro games to begin with. But for me, Dick Vermeil represented that the college spirit that I love so much, the attention to detail and everyone being on the same page to try and accomplish a winning season. And I believed him. When he said in 3 years we'll be world champs, I listened to every word he said, and I said, man, I'm going to be part of the solution, not the problem. And, 3 years later, of course, you know, it's the rest is history. But, those early years in St. Louis, I mean, they were magical. It was a great time, to be in St. Louis.
And you were a Vermeil believer from early on. I'm wondering in the room, though, so 97, 98, things don't go well. And Dick has said this. He goes, hell, I'm lucky I made it to that third year. He told John Shaw, they had a meeting after 98, and he said, John, I think we're going to be good next year. And John's like, oh, my God, Dick, I've heard that my whole life. I've been telling. And Dick's like, no, this is different. And I said,
that's a nice impression, by the way.
Well, John's voice is burned into my head. Who, by the way, did the podcast a year ago. He doesn't do anything. And we got him. He was great. Stories about Georgia and growing up in L.A. or not growing up, but being a young guy with the Rams. And so he Vermeil convinces John we're going to be better. But I'm wondering, those 2 years when you struggled, and guys, and there was mutiny at the end of 98. Remember, guys didn't, not telling you to remember, yep, but guys didn't get on the plane coming back from San Francisco. Were you an advocate in the room saying, hey, hold on, guys, this is going to work. Just hang in there. Or how divided was it when it wasn't working?
It was somewhat divided. You know, we had just divisive elements, people who, you know, really hadn't bought in. And, you know, and like I said, you could be part of the problem or part of the solution. And, you know, we hadn't gotten everyone, you know, on the same page. So there was still that aspect of our team that still persisted. And I was, you know, part of the contingency, of course, that was, you know, like, hey, you know, you can't control, you know, what we do. All you can control is your actions. You know, try to be the best, you know, version of yourself that you can be and bring that to the team, you know. And I was still on that kick. I mean, you know, maybe I was built different, maybe because of where I'd come from, maybe because of my love and belief in Coach Vermeil to actually make this thing work. And also, you know, my leftover faith and hope in forging something real. I mean, I was the first round pick in St. Louis. And all those guys like myself and Todd Light and Keith Lyle, DeMarco Farr, you know, we took it upon ourselves. We wanted to see this thing turn around. We wanted to be there when it did turn around. We wanted to be the reason that this thing turned around. And, you know, what more justification, gratification, you know, can you have in life than a situation like that? I mean, everyone wants to be part of that, but, you know, you find out that not everyone has the intestinal fortitude to see it through. And that's exactly what it was in that moment. I'm glad that he had that conversation with John Shaw and he got one more chance, because about midway through training camp, after we had picked up, you know, a few, you know, key pieces, a talented free agent quarterback by the name of Trent Green, you know, this former first round pick who was absolutely amazing and doing things just north of us in Indianapolis, and the name of Marshall Faulk. And then we picked up Torrey Holt and we already had Ricky Prohl. You know, we had the pieces, you know, of our offense that we thought we needed. And we knew that we were a different team just from the mini camps and practicing and working out in the off season. But when we got to training camp, you know, there was a profound difference in the efficiency of our offense. All of the things that we've been, you know, teaching and trying to make happen, you know, were starting to come true. And we saw that in the preseason games. But, you know, we had already laid the groundwork for who we were the 2 years prior. I mean, Frank Gans, you know, walking around with a portable speaker on his back, you know, yes, preaching, you know, same arm, same leg, 6-inch rising blow, head across the bow, you know, all these different things, our turnover circuit, our awareness, our attention to the possession of the football and how big turnovers were in our game, and all the little things, the metrics, the football, collective football IQ of our group, and also the intrinsic esprit de corps that we needed to build to have the indomitable spirit as to where you never wanted to let the other man down. You know, those things that we were trying to forge and trying to build, I mean, you know, that was, it meant everything to us. It basically came to fruition. And, you know, that third year, about midway through training camp, you know, Coach Vermeil, he stopped practice, called us all up, and he says, hey, you know, you guys are ready. You know, we're ready to change things up. And, you know, I didn't know what he was talking about, but he starts crying in the middle of the field. He says, we're going to change practice up. You know, everyone go inside. You know, we're in the middle of another 3-hour grueling practice, you know, in full pads. And, you know, he says, we're going to go have, you know, pizza. We're going to have drinks at the Purple Pride, which was this little dive bar on the corner of Western Illinois University's campus. And we went and just had a party. And the next day, we saw the schedule, and it was like we were in shells. And the practice schedule was like, you know, was like an hour and 45 minutes long. And we looked at each other like, man, hey, we can't screw this up. You know, we got to get this right. But, you know, we had a certain amount of efficiency that we were building. And like I said, with those leaders that I just called out, you know, our defense was pretty much well on its way. We had a lot of pride on the side of the ball, and we played tough regardless of how the other side of the ball performed. And we wanted, and we, you know, set out every weekend to take our respect regardless of the outcome or how many points we scored. But we finally had all the pieces. Everything changed from that moment. Everything about who we were. We were efficient. We were quick. We were smart. We, you know, everyone was attuned to the goal of winning, making us better. And we never looked back from that moment on. I mean, from the first game on, even when Trent goes down in the last preseason game and Kurt steps in. I mean, Kurt was running our scout team the year before, and, you know, we had to keep repeating plays because he was so money. You know, I'm getting mad at Todd Light and Keith Lyle and those guys because we got to repeat plays. And they're like, look, man, homeboy just doesn't miss. And, you know, he was that good. And we knew he was that good. We knew what we had in him. And, you know, like I said, the rest is all cliche because it was all just a wonderful memory.
It's interesting. He knew, like, when to pull back, and he knew even – it might have been DeMarco who told stories. DeMarco Farr said, you know, in the team meetings on Tuesday or whatever it was, Coach would always – Wednesday morning, whatever it was, he would talk about a former player. And, like, after a few weeks in a row of what a great kid, what a great story, maybe that could get old. And then he says after about 3 or 4 weeks, then he tells a story about a former player. Then he says, what an asshole he was. He, like, knew how to mix it up. Like, he knew how to change the tone. Just like your practice. All you guys are, oh, he's going to beat us into the ground again. But, no, he knew, like, when it was time. And even that year, there's so many different things that pop into my head. But we had Rocky Arsenault on the show, and he was Marshall's agent, and he tells the story. Marshall's mad at Bill Polian. Got to get out of Indy. Wants a new deal, whatever. And he tells Rocky, hey, you got to get me to a warm weather city, get me off turf, get me to a winning team. And Rocky's like, yo, bro, I went 0-3. I got you to St. Louis on the turf. And Marshall's like, oh, my God, the Rams. And he said he didn't want to go, like, to the mini camp. And Rocky's like, you got to just show up, meet the guys. And he said after that one camp, Marshall called him and said, this team shouldn't be bad. Look around. Look at all the players. Like, he knew that you guys had a loaded roster, 99, and it was going to happen. It was going to have the breakthrough. But the Vermeil stories, there's so many, but when I hear him talk about you, he never says, like, Kevin. He'll say Kevin and Shima or Kevin and his son. He was always about people's family. I mean, he would stop John Knetzer, the janitor, and say, Johnny, how's your son, your sister, your mother, whatever. It's unbelievable. And I asked him, where does that come from? And he said, my town I grew up in was 1800, and we knew everybody. My friend's dad was my dad. My friend's mom was my mom. And he sort of carried that through. And you had a lot of stops in the NFL, and that's just rare, isn't it, where a coach cares more than X's and O's, really, like, doesn't pay lip service either, just wants to know about your family.
Extremely. Goes a long way. The thing about that is, you say, where does it come from? Well, it came from his, obviously, how he grew up, but he built it. I mean, he built it organically, you know, and here's this guy who's, you know, killing us in practice, you know, demanding more of us than we think we can give. But at the same time, he's got a huge smoker in his house and a full, you know, wine cellar in his house. And he's having guys over, you know, by position, you know, in groups, you know, with their spouses. And he's cooking for you. He's opening a bottle of wine. He's talking to you. He's getting to know you. He's getting into your life. He's setting roots, and there's accountability when he walks up to you. And when he, you know, when someone like that makes promises and they tell you about playing time and how you're going to be used, and, you know, that's a lot of accountability. It's a lot to have to answer for, but he did it. He set it in motion so that, you know, you're almost, you know, you might be dissatisfied with the situation and how things are working out, but you couldn't fault him for his effort and the love that he put into you. And, you know, going down you know, the roster and breaking bread with everyone, you know, making sure, like you said, John Knetzer was a building manager, for God's sakes. I mean, he knew everything about everyone in that organization, but therein lied the difference right there. You hit the nail on the head. That was the bottling thing that you could, you know, bottle and become a rich man. That was the element that was there organically. When we went on our tear that 99 season, everyone in that building knew or believed, at least, that their contribution, no matter how big or how small, whether they were in administration or they ran the building or they cleaned up the building or washed the cars at the building or put stickers on helmets or taped ankles or did whatever, you know, whatever, everyone in that organization from top to bottom believed that their contribution was the difference between winning and losing. And when we won, everybody won. And that was the thing. It was like, it was uncanny. I'd never been a part of something like that before. I mean, it was the closest thing to, you know, being in college and, you know, winning a Southeastern Conference championship that I can get. I mean, it was the closest feeling to that old college spirit of togetherness. It wasn't like a typical NFL team. And, you know, I'm sad to say that, you know, I never had quite that feeling before. Played on some good teams, played for some really, really good head coaches. You know, Jeff Fisher was a great man, ran a great organization. They had a lot of what we had. Obviously, they wouldn't have gotten as far as they did if they didn't. And I discovered that when I went into that locker room after being in our locker room for so many years. But hard to find in pro football, people that go the extra mile to make the relationship secure so that they can win.
And we talk about, you know, Vermeil's success, you win a Super Bowl, but everybody talks about the parade. It's unbelievable, like how, and it shouldn't have been. I missed it. I was on a flight back from Atlanta. What the hell were we thinking? They did it the next day. You're supposed to take a couple of days. Right. We were so surprised we had a Super Bowl champion. We're like, hey, we got to have a parade. Let's do it now. What is your recollection of that day? Coach just says, it was cold. I remember it was cold. But he also pointed out, he and Carroll looked to the streets, and he said, I would see people wearing a mink coat, and the person next to him might have been homeless. He said, I could tell everybody from every socioeconomic group was represented. What are your memories of that day?
First off, it was an absolute blur. I remember coming back to my room at, you know, goodness knows what time in the morning after the party, and, you know, they told us that we had to have our bags, you know, that we were going to check on the plane outside of our room. So I remember just taking out the clothes that I was going to wear back on the plane and packing my backpack, you know, with my music and, you know, a couple of snacks or whatever, toiletries. And I put my bags outside of my room and I went to sleep. And next thing you know, we're on a plane back to St. Louis, you know, I'm there. And then the next day, you know, I'm packing another bag because there's about nine of us that are heading over to Hawaii the next day after the parade. So, you know, we're on a whirlwind tour at this point, but when getting to the parade, it was cold it was cold. It was freezing outside, but I remember it seemed like the entire city of St. Louis was downtown. I mean, everyone and their mom had come out of the woodwork to celebrate. I mean, it was almost like a day of healing, you know, where everything that had happened to St. Louis from, you know, the Bidwell days and the Cardinals and everything else, it's like everything was finally made right. We brought home that championship and it was, you know, it was just, it was magical because of the stark contrast, you know, and lack of success that we'd had to that point. And I remember our fans were so happy. And being there at that parade, I mean, it was a culmination of years of frustration. I mean, you know, I went through 2 years of losing under Rich Brooks, and then I went through two more years of losing under Dick Vermeil, and a lot of frustration, a lot of, you know, reconciling between, okay, you know, we're not very good, but I got to go play my best, you know, and, you know, am I being a team player? Do I try to get my stats, or am I, you know, how am I playing the game? And there was so much thought as to, you know, how you could make the best contribution and if you were making that contribution. And it was just, It was a hard time to, you know, for me to have four straight years of just miserable existence. Don't get me wrong, I love my job and I love preparing for my job, but it was no fun losing for all that time. But you know, that parade, you know, that was it. We finally made it, you know, like the sun had finally come up after so much rain, and we were world champs, and no one could take that away from us. I literally wanted to just go and, you know, gloat and laugh in every other team's face and just, you know, shout it from the rooftops. I wanted to climb up on top of the arch and shout that we were world champs. I mean, it was probably one of the greatest days, you know, of my life.
Yeah, and not the same old Rams anymore. That stupid phrase just kept – the Niners brought it up, and, that stuck for a while. And you are the answer to the trivia question, the original St. Louis Ram, first pick ever for the St. Louis Rams. And you love impressions. Your old PR guy, Rick Smith, said to me, he goes, hey, what I remember, hey, we're at Matthew's Dickey, and you had to cross the train track just to freaking practice, and it was a disaster. I mean, I had not moved back yet. What was that 95 like when the team was here but the facility wasn't ready? I mean, what was that experience like?
That experience was – it was so weird because I didn't know what to expect. You know, it was my first experience as a professional athlete. I had nothing else to compare it to. Just my college experience, and you know, being in a makeshift facility and being in the old boys, Matthew's Dickey Boys Club. I mean, I remember, man, fighting traffic, you know, going down King's Highway to get to Boys Club, and I mean, it was nice enough, and you know what? I mean, it worked, but it was temporary. You know, it wasn't our home, and you know, we're trying to get in our stadium. We're getting in our stadium. We're trying to get in our new facility. I mean, just, you know, so much was just, you know, we were uprooted is not really the correct word, but we just really had no home. We weren't, you know, we hadn't really bound ourselves to the city. I think the thing that really helped out when we first got there was being 5-0. I mean, we got off to just a quick start. And we were playing those games in Busch Stadium, and you know, the Rams fans in St. Louis were great people, but we gave them something initially, you know, to cheer for, only to let them down.
False sense of excitement, right?
Yeah, but it started off really with a lot of excitement, and it was an exciting time. I mean, it was, like I said, it was a whirlwind for me personally because I was a kid, man. I was 21 years old, and I mean, I remember going up to Green Bay, getting my first quarterback sack, and then, you know, having an auto accident and wrecking my dealer car. You know, I mean, this was so long ago, and it was just a weird magical time. So I really didn't know anything from anything. I was just trying to make sense of the new world that I had, you know, played myself into. And so it was, that time was just pretty much flying by the seat of my pants, you know, trying to adjust to the pressure of being a first round pick and not wanting you guys to start writing bad articles that I was going to be a bust or anything like that. And just trying to earn my keep, really.
Well, 17 sacks in 99, two-time Pro Bowler, over 100 career sacks. Was the first one, would that have been Favre in Green Bay?
Mm-hmm.
Your first sack was Brett freaking Favre. I didn't know that.
Brett Favre.
Wow. And then, like I said, 17 in the 99 year. What happened defensively in 2000? Because obviously things were – I know Mike Martz came in, replaced his coach, but the team offensively was still good. What do you think the drop-off would be attributed to defensively?
Probably just chemistry, from a team standpoint. Anytime you make an adjustment offensively, you know, your defense has to adjust accordingly. And when I say that, it's, you know, how quickly you score, how you maintain the ball, your attention to detail when it comes to turning the ball over, how, you know, what you do, you know, in closing minutes of quarters, how much time you give the opponent to, you know, winning the battle of vertical field position, all those technical things, you know, probably attribute to why we didn't have quite the same amount of success that we had the year prior. And plus, you know, people know you're coming. So people plan for what you do. And, you know, our offense was darn near unstoppable at the time. You know, the concepts that Mike Morris was putting out there, you know, were relatively new. We had so many viable targets in the passing game, but, you know, you've also got Marshall Faulk in the backfield. So it's just one of those things where, you know, you really couldn't be right, and people were hard-pressed to really figure us out. So, you know, that was one of the things. But defensively, you know, like I said, we had to adjust to how we played on offense. We were a little bit more ball control under Dick Vermeil, dare I say. And, the, you know, the overall mentality wasn't quite so offense first. You know, when an offensive coordinator becomes the head coach, then, you know, some little adjustments happen, you know, when your offense that affect, you know, your outcome of, you know, your entire team. And I think that's more of what it was, more so than us not being. I mean, it's the same defense and a lot of the same people, but, you know, trying to keep up with our offense for how they scored, how quickly they scored, and, you know, keeping the game under control from turnovers and vertical field position, that was our biggest challenge, I think, in 2000.
And your son is in college now, but I remember his birth. It was somewhat famous because Coach Martz was mad you weren't at practice. Harold Lewis, your agent, says that's not true. They knew he was going to be excused. You were having a baby, and so you go. Did you and Coach Martz, you get sideways? Do you think you would have still been in St. Louis, or did that moment lead to a fractured relationship?
It led to a fractured relationship, unfortunately. So, you know, one of those things where, you know, since then, the years have gone by, and, you know, you're a different person as an older man. You know, I've since made peace with Mike. I mean, you know, seeing him at various, you know, Hall of Fame inductions and gatherings of, you know, in the football universe, and, you know, and both of us, you know, walk up and shake hands, look at each other like, man, you know, we really would have handled that so much different if we could go back in time right now, you know, and both of us have, like, both of us have the same kind of pervasive attitude. I mean, I was young. I was in the middle of a contract squabble. I was frustrated because, you know, here I was, you know, performing like one of the best defensive ends in football. And, you know, my pay didn't reflect that. And it didn't look like I was going to get the deal that I wanted, you know, from the Rams. And, you know, there is a harsh reality of business to this, you know, to this business of football. And, you know, you're not playing for the money, but you definitely can't go out there and run through brick walls without it. And for me, you know, I'd earned that. And when I'm standing, you know, over in Hawaii, and I'm standing, you know, in the huddle with, you know, Michael Strahan and Robert Porche and John Abraham and, you know, Simeon Rice, rather, that were on my team, and I've got more sacks than all of them, but I'm the lowest paid guy there. You know, I'm like, dude, we got to get this fixed. And I think, you know, Mike took that personal, like it was a reflection on him, like I didn't want to play for him. You know, maybe I was one of Dick Vermeil's guys, which I was, you know, and but he thought that loyalty might carry over to me being a little, you know, miffed about the contract that I hadn't gotten. And, you know, and so when things become personal and they get out of the business lane and they come into the personal lane, that's when people start making mistakes on how to handle situations. And I think that's all it was. I mean, there was really nothing more to it than that. And yes, the Rams knew exactly where I was. You know, you ask yourself about me and about my MO. Well, you know, hindsight is a perfect science. Okay. 14 years, never missed a game in my entire life. Didn't miss a game in high school. Didn't miss a game in college. I didn't miss practice, and I missed a practice. And the result of me missing that practice meant that I got the entire day itemized, and I got fined like $18,000 for missing a day of practice. Like, I missed my morning weigh-in, I missed my workout, I missed the team meeting, I missed the D-line meeting. I mean, I missed everything. And, you know, I'm in the hospital because, you know, the kid's jaundice and, you know, complications and, you know, I'm taking a day off of work, man. I haven't missed a day of work in 5 years, and you know I'm going to be there on Sunday. So, you know, it was a little bit blown out of proportion. And obviously when the media gets hold of things, and then, you know, the result of it is I got fined and I got benched for the first two or three plays. that weekend. And, you know, I'm fuming. I'm on the sideline. I'm pissed off. I'm, you know, wanting to go in the game. My pride is hurt. I'm embarrassed. You know, here I am, the best defensive end in football, and I'm being disrespected. Like who does that? You know, who takes one of your best players off the field because you're pissed off because someone missed a day at work because they had a baby? I mean, who does that? I'm mad on all fronts. Like I said, I mean, if you talk to Mike Martz, I can't speak for him, but I can only speak, you know, in the dealings that he and I have had since then, and I can say that both of us would have handled it probably a lot different. And dare I say, I might have never left St. Louis. But, hey, the rest is history. You can't get time back, and you live and you learn. And for me, personally, God bless the broken road, because I had a wonderful, blessed career.
Yeah, and I've always thought about it. The original St. Louis Ram would have been nice if the run were a little longer. I think you were like the lead story that it's crazy to think about. It just seems so punitive, too. Like, if you say, listen, we had a misunderstanding, we're moving on, but then the fining makes it even more. That just furthers the riff. Well, let's move on from that. I do remember that being like a huge TV story. My colleague Pete Peterson had talked to Harold Lewis, and it was like our top story. But you had Vermeil, Martz, Fisher. We got to know Fisher, and I did his coach's show for 4 years. I would say he has to be the closest thing to a player's coach. Like, just kind of gets it as a former player and knows how to have fun. You had Gruden in college. You had Spurrier. Give me an idea what you took away from that. I mean, that's a pretty unique mix of personalities.
Yes, and you're forgetting the 2 years in Miami during the Nick Saban NFL experience.
That's
experiment,
right.
Rather.
That's right.
That was a Nick Saban experiment.
He was just passing through. He was passing through, yes.
Yeah, just had a great experience playing for a lot of great coaches. And I think, you know, the biggest lesson I can take from that is, you know, how to be your best self in different situations. You know, I've always said that the best head coaches are really, really good managers of personalities. You know, they're people that can do kind of and create what I was talking about earlier, from the getting everyone to buy in, everyone to believe that their contribution is the difference between winning and losing. And, you know, I played for different people who did it all in different ways, but a lot of them, you know, were very successful in doing it. Obviously, you know, going to play for Jeff Fisher, you know, they had a great group there. You know, I went to, you know, the playoffs, you know, 2 of the 4 years that I was there, lost to the Raiders in the AFC Championship game, had another chance to possibly go to another Super Bowl in 2003 there. So, you know, just great experiences, you know, with different coaches. You know, Gruden was great. Ran a really good organization. I got here and, you know, got to here in Tampa, and he was, you know, he ran a great group. You know, there were guys like Derek Brooks. There was Rondé Barber. There were a bunch of leaders that were established, and a great group of guys. You know, the kids got to come to the facility on Saturday morning and run around and, you know, eat pancakes and popsicles and hang out and stuff. And I remember bringing my son to work when he was, you know, just 6, 7 years old on Saturday. So I had great experiences holistically, you know, through my career. But I tell you, you know, I can truly say, looking back on it, there was nothing quite like being in St. Louis during the Super Bowl year. I mean, it was a magical time, and it just means so much more the further I get away from it, because it's just unique in my memory, because I've never had anything happen like that before in my life, and just, you know, thankful to have been a part of that, and thankful to have been, you know, there when we first got there, but also there for the change. And I think that's the most gratifying part, is, you know, people saying those same old sorry-ass Rams and everything else and laughing, you know, but, you know, they have respect for individual pieces. And they say, oh, you guys are going to be good someday. Keep your head up, young buck, and, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, it's patronizing, and you're like, whatever, you know. And this kind of like a moral victory. But being able to, you know, to come full circle and bring home a world championship, that means everything.
Well, and I keep hearing voices in my head, and one of them was Keith Lyle. And this is when they brought you guys back for the 15-year anniversary. It was a Monday night game. And Lyle is standing next to me. And in 97, 98, I'm the post-game reporter. We always had these post-game shows. And I had to grab guys. Man, Keith Lyle saved me so many games after a bad loss. He'd come out and talk, and T. Light would talk. And we're standing on the sideline, and it's 2014. He's like, man, thank God we won that Super Bowl because we were jokers for a while. You would not be inviting us back for no reason. And I'm like, it turned quickly. How about a final thought? When they went to L.A., and granted, they came from L.A. Some players are real pragmatic about it. Isaac has been the torchbearer to continue sort of that St. Louis legacy. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you can go out to L.A. You're a Rams great, you know, and I'm sure you're invited at times. But how is it for the players? Kind of weird?
Kind of weird. I mean, it's, you know, I went back for this for the Super Bowl this past year. I actually took my son, had a nice little father-son moment out there, which was great because it was nice to be able to share that. But, you know, it's a different organization, you know, and as nice as they are about engagement, you know, the continuity isn't quite there to the level that, you know, you would want it to be just because, you know, it's a different city, you know, and it's not, you don't have the same connection. And they're really good about, you know, they'll bring you out to a game and they'll put you up and, you know, they engage, but there's really a disconnect, you know, from what we built so many years ago, just the continuity of the organization. You know, it's hard to keep those lines. I think, you know, the Los Angeles Rams winning a world championship kind of in a funny way kind of brings it full circle because, you know, to date, you know, they didn't have any other world championships. So, you know, having that Super Bowl crown be in St. Louis, you know, was a point of pride. And I know it is for people in St. Louis. And I know that, you know, maybe, you know, there are some sour grapes and people have, you know, wishing that the team had never left. And, you know, in a perfect world, you know, you'd like to have that continuity. But I think, you know, now that, you know, there's another Super Bowl, hopefully, you know, we can bridge the gap between, you know, us old St. Louis Rams and the current Rams and really become, you know, one prideful organization again. But yeah, that's, unfortunately, it's not quite the same, you know, as it's coming back. Because I would love nothing more than to be able to come back to a game in St. Louis and take my kid to a game in St. Louis. That was really cool when I came back for the Rams reunion. My son was 12. You know, that was really cool. It would be nice to still do that. And it's an absolute travesty that there is no NFL team in St. Louis. So shame on you, NFL.
Well, it's great to talk to you. And you know what? Next time I'll call you. It won't be This Is Your Life. We won't talk about Baby Gate or Rams. We'll talk some college football. People can catch you. CBS Sports. I mean, and people can tell how articulate you are. You're always a great soundbite, a great interview. And the thing about the great announcers, too, and this is, you know, Marshall had this. You had every once in a while there'd be an edge. And if somebody came, I remember, unnamed reporter said, hey, Vermeil said your knees hurt. And you go, hey, learn how to ask a question. My knee's not hurt. The great ones have a little bit of an edge. In fact, it was in Macomb. I went up to you with, like, the revamped schedule, and I said, hey, it looks like Vermeil's backing off. And you said something akin to, Martin, don't start that SH or something like it was like. But looking forward to it. We'll see you on TV talking some college football very soon.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying my gig at CBS Sports. It's a lot of fun. I'm such a football junkie, and it allows me to be close to the games that I love so much. And, yeah, I'm there every weekend. I'm the resident studio analyst along with Houston Nutt of CBS Sports on with Brent Stover every Friday and Saturday. So tune in.
And I think we have to add Kevin Carter to our list of people you'd sit around at the bar and have beers with and just tell stories. I mean, we could do an hour podcast of just him telling Jeff Fisher stories, Vermeil behind-the-scenes stories, Steve Spurrier, John Gruden. I mentioned this at the intro, the number of different coaches he played for, the absolute characters that he played for. I mean, we could get really dig in on some of those names from his football past. What a great guy. Very articulate, as mentioned. His son's playing football at Dartmouth. He's a tight end. So file that name away. Zion Carter up at Dartmouth. I'm going to try and peek some of those stats this fall. If I forget, remind me. But
Great to catch up. Always fun to hear from a former Ram, but especially a guy that you don't hear a lot about. And he was here day one, the old Matthews Dickey days when the Rams first arrived from L.A. We appreciate you checking us out. If you can, subscribe. They're always on me. Make sure you tell them to subscribe. It's a big deal. So if you can, subscribe to the Kilcoin Conversation. That way everything is delivered directly to you. You can also go online at scoopswithdannymack.com, where all of the segments are posted with the Cardinals broadcaster. Dan McLaughlin has the great website. We're on Spotify. We're on iTunes. And we appreciate you checking out our content. It's presented, as always, by Triad Bank, Marie Davila Senior Living, Appliance Discounters, and B&G Tuck Pointing. So if you need tuck pointing done, you call B&G, 363-0525. Need a new appliance? Stop by Appliance Discounters. Home loan, car loan, business loan, make sure you check out the folks at Triad Bank. And whether the retirement is for yourself, senior years for your aunt, uncle, parents, check out Marie Davila in West County. Thanks for checking out the Kilcoin Conversation. We'll talk to you again soon.